If you ask the best in the world the single greatest secret to success, they'll smile and give a gentle laugh. You're asking the wrong question. Being extraordinary is not a single element. It cannot be distilled down to one thing. We're told that being a success is a magical thing that happens in a place you'll arrive. The hard part is that this long-held truth is the biggest lie. Extraordinary features humans that have reached the top of their field and become extraordinary humans. The door to being extraordinary is now open. Will you walk in?
Hey everybody, Jeremy here, and guys, I am really excited for the guest that I have for you guys today. He's visited more than 60 countries worldwide for the likes of National Geographic, The New Yorker, among others. He's also written Vagabonding, an uncommon guide to the art of long-term world travel. In addition, Marco Polo didn't go there, so he's done some really, really awesome things, including being an author and adventurer, and I feel like he's really formed the voice for a lot of what's going on with this generation in terms of how we want to see the world differently. Welcome to the Create Your Own Life podcast, Rolf Potts.
Happy to be here.
I am really excited to be here today and dive into things with you today, Rolf. And one of the things I like to start out with when I have people on is when people ask you, what do? How do you respond to that?
You know, I usually say that I'm a travel writer. The reality is a little bit more complicated, but yeah, usually I say travel writer or writer or journalist. Sometimes I say journalist just because people are like crazy curious about being a travel writer, and that leads to a very detailed conversation, which is fine sometimes, but journalist just keeps it simple.
I love that. That's awesome. Well, I wanted to find out a little bit of, I guess, your origin story, a little bit of your story. And I've heard you talk about before that one of the things that actually convinced you to look at travel was your grandmother and Alzheimer's. Is that correct?
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I've been close with my family, with both sides of my family my whole life. And my grandmother and my grandfather were a farm couple. You know, they'd been working a farm, raised six kids in Kansas, and really worked hard their whole lives, as farmers do. And about the time my grandfather retired, my grandmother got Alzheimer's disease, and they really couldn't enjoy their retirement. And so I was a teenager at the time, and I was being encouraged, as many young Americans are, that you have to go from school to school to graduate school, get a degree, work hard, and you can indulge your free time when you retire, you know. But I had just seen somebody I was very close to, my grandfather, not be able to enjoy the time of his retirement. And so at a very impressionable time in my life, I realized that virtue and hard work doesn't reward you with free time, and you have to be pretty careful in creating time for yourself now. And so that's what I've been trying to do for more than 20 years now.
That's awesome. And what did really that first vagabonding trip for you, what was that like? Because I think for a lot of us, there's so much hesitance and I want to travel, I want to see things. And I think especially with the rise of digital entrepreneurship and a lot of these things, it has become easier, but you know, you did it before a lot of that existed. What was that like for you?
Yeah. You know, there's less mystery now. You know, if you, from any walk of life, you can go online and probably find somebody who's traveling, who's of your age and background, and so it's less of a mystery. When I was starting travel, when I was planning my first vagabonding trip, I didn't have those resources. This was like 93, 94, and I was sort of operating, I was just sort of winging it, and I sort of had this mindset that, you know, because of things I had seen in my life, that I was going to travel while I was young, get it out of my system, and then become a normal American workaholic. And of course, the trip itself taught me that I didn't have to do that. I just learned that travel was easier and cheaper and safer and more enjoyable than I even thought it would be. One thing I did early on that helped, one is that I set in stone a day. It was New Year's Day, 1994. It's been a long time now. that I was going to leave, you know, wherever I was, however much money I had, I was going to leave on New Year's Day, 1994. And then I did most of that trip with a friend of mine from college. And I've been a solo traveler pretty much ever since. But having someone to be accountable with, that and when we were in college, he and I would go to the library and take out maps and talk and plan about once a week. And I think that was useful less for the planning we did than just the motivation and the fact that we're looking each other in the eyes and we're going to go, you know, that we can't quit the plan because we're holding each other accountable. So that was very helpful too. And then just did the trip, and I've been traveling ever since, and I've been applying, you know, the lessons I've learned to books like Vagabonding, and it's been awesome. It was a huge turning point for me.
You mentioned the idea of solo travel there, and I've heard you kind of speak to this before, that it's a way different experience when you travel solo. And I can totally agree with you on that, because I know my wife and I are big travelers and we've gone to many, many countries. But like the time, like I spent a month in Peru, which was somewhat on my own. Like, I think it is a very different experience for, you know, how even enriching it is.
Yeah, it leaves you open to a place in a way that traveling with a partner doesn't. And even that first trip when I was traveling with a buddy most of the time, there are times where I felt like going my own way. And, you know, we were able to travel independently of each other quite a bit. And I suspect that you and your wife probably have figured out ways to be somewhat independent and not be attached to each other the whole time.
Yeah.
But there's really something, like one thing that's even harder for me to achieve now, or for people to achieve, was like traveling alone makes you lonely sometimes. And that sounds bad, but actually being lonely forces you to meet people. You know, it forces you to get out of your shell. It forces you to find ways to interact with the people in the place where you are. And you, instead of just falling back on the normal routine conversations you have with someone you know well, it forces you to create social situations with people, you know, who are living right where you're traveling.
Do you think that kind of enhances the cultural experience for you more than if you were to travel in a group?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Just because even with a group of extroverts, you're sort of interacting as a group and sort of absorbing the culture as a group. Whereas if, you know, when you're on your own, you are completely focused on the culture. There's no other place where your focus is going, and you're interacting with people and sort of becoming dependent upon them, to everything from finding a place to eat to making your day more interesting. And I think it just allows immersion, and if you fall in love with the place, you can stay there for as long as you like. If you make some friends in some city or village, there's nobody tugging on your shirt sleeve and saying, our itinerary says this. You know, you can sort of decide to go or stay whenever you choose.
It's interesting you say that too, because I think as Americans, we have such this like uniquely American culture that we tend to bring it with us everywhere, where we're not always open to experiencing, or I think if we get out of that group, it does change it. It's interesting to look at it that way.
Yeah, you know, the overseas stereotype is that we're noisy and we travel in packs together. And I think Americans are just exuberant. We like to have fun. And sometimes if you get a couple of us together, we end up being noisier than everybody else there. But I think, you know, the flip side of that is that listening is such an important part of cross-cultural travel. And if you travel alone, then you have to become more dependent on other people, dependent on the people who are living in the place where you are, and just be a little bit of a quieter American and be more interactive. And I found that people are really curious about and friendly towards Americans in most every part of the world, counter to some stereotypes people might have, is that, you know, everybody is familiar with America in some sense, be it from movies or music or whatever. And I've just found people very welcoming as I've traveled as an American. One corollary to all this is that you can travel alone these days, but if you have your smartphone, you can be texting and posting on social media all day and sort of have half of your brain back home. And so it's even harder. It's weird that solo travel is now less solo than it used to be. So I think a way to take advantage of the gifts of solo travel is to turn your smartphone off and leave yourself open to being lost and lonely and bored, and just sort of using your environment as your social media platform.
I think that's really interesting too, because I think like especially as creatives, right, we need to have that space to be able to like think and create and come up with things. And I think social media really has changed it so we don't really go away anymore. Because I know even for myself, if I'm not checking my email often enough, I'm freaking out if somebody in my business needs me. So I think though the world has gotten smaller in some ways, it's kind of the internet has kind of ruined some of these, the way we travel and whatnot.
Yeah, it's a two-sided coin, or however, whatever cliche you want to apply. I mean, it's so much accessible, and there's you have fewer and fewer excuses to not travel. You know, there's just so much information available, and it's easy to get around. But at the same time, it's this what I call the electronic umbilical cord, is that you haven't fully left home, that a part of you is back home. And I am subject to this as much as anyone. I try to discipline myself off of, in fact, I don't ever get overseas data plans or anything. When I'm traveling, I might have my smartphone, but I only use it in Wi-Fi situations. But even then, you can become really dependent upon it. One winter ago, I spent this last winter in Africa. The year before, I was in South America, and I was in this cabin up on the Chilean border. And it was really weird. It was like time travel to not have any internet at all. I had to get in a truck and drive like 30 miles down the mountain to check email. And it was a little weird sometimes, because it's like, oh, what if something happened to my family? And it's like, well, when does anything ever happen to your family over a 7-day period? And so in a way, I felt awkward in a very 21st century way. Basically, I was doing something that would have been normal when I was, two decades younger, when you didn't even have that option. But it was fun. It was actually refreshing. I felt more energy being up in that cabin, just because I had no temptation to check my social media feeds or email or anything online, because I had no option. And it was a really, it was like a data fast, you know, and it was great.
Awesome. Well, Rolf, I actually got a few listener submitted questions for you for this interview as well. And we had Jake Heilbrunn wanted to know, what's the number one rule that someone should follow in vagabonding?
Well, there's several phases of vagabonding. And I think my number one rule will be something that happens early in the process. And that is, make it concrete. Decide that it's going to happen. The first step, as I say in the book, of vagabonding is now. It's today. Even if you don't have your passport and your backpack full for another 3 or 4 years, the journey really starts when you decide that it's going to happen and you're going to stop making excuses. And without that moment, then nothing else counts. You can dream about vagabonding for 20 or 30 years and never do it. But it's until you have that time, that X on the calendar, however many months or years away, that's when it becomes real. And actually, I talk a lot about how travel is a mindset. It's not just a set of rules for packing your bags or buying airplane tickets, but it's a way of seeing and moving through the world. And that can start the moment you decide to do it. And oftentimes, what is keeping us from traveling next week is money. But earning money with the knowledge that you have this amazing journey coming up in a year or two just makes that process so much more joyful. So that's my number one rule. Make it concrete, make a plan, decide that you're going to do it and start living towards that plan.
That's awesome. And you mentioned there, the mindset and whatnot that goes into it. Like, how do you think vagabonding mentally changes us? Like, if you had to look at, you know, even yourself or some of the people that you've worked with, like, how do you think it mentally changes us?
I think it decompartmentalizes us a little bit. It takes us out of our bubble. Because our bubbles at home, and I don't want to knock home or knock anyone who's not interested in travel, but so many of our assumptions and about social status and what's important and what's interesting and what we should be doing comes from this bubble of home, which of course now includes all of these social media streams, which are also tied into status and sometimes are very performative. So I think that mindset is just being open to non-prescribed experiences of like, so I don't have a plan. I'm not going to buy into what I think I want to do. I'm just going to be in the world and see what happens and find out what I really love to do as opposed to what I think I might love to do. And it's an ongoing process. It changes as you change. But I think the people who come back, some people can achieve this mindset before they leave, but I think it really hits home once you've started traveling and you meet people who are often in the same situation as you, even if they're from a different age or background, and they're just experiencing that freedom and they're open to experiences. And suddenly you're in Namibia or New Zealand and you're having these amazing conversations with near strangers that you would never have with your friends back home. It just sort of throws off the limits that you set for yourself back home. And ideally, you bring that limit-free mindset back home with you after you travel and just sort of live in such a way that you don't really stop traveling, even if you're back home.
And for you, like, what was that, I guess, biggest experience you feel like you've done on travel that back home you would have just been like, you know, no way, man. Well, what was that experience for you?
In a way, it's almost everything, because I'm a little bit of an introvert. And so I think it's easier to be an introvert back home. And actually, that's one challenge I have in carrying the mindset of travel back home, is that I'm instinctively an introvert. And sometimes I avoid experiences at home that I would have when I'm traveling, just because when I'm traveling, I'm in a mode where I am more outward looking. And so, yeah, I think that's really it, is that travel teaches me to break out of my shell a little bit and realize that there's so much interesting and joyful things to be gained just by talking to people and interacting and sort of getting into window into other people's lives and making friends. It's awesome.
Very cool. I don't know. I read this article recently about a piece of technology that's being worked on called the Hyperloop. I'm not sure if you're familiar with it, Rolf, but it's the idea of really like shortening travel. And they were saying LA to New York City, 30 minutes or something like that. And At first I kind of looked at that and like, wow, that's exciting. I can get somewhere very quickly. But then I kind of had this, I guess, a little bit of longing for losing the journey, which to me was really upsetting. How do you think like the future of travel is really going to change how we experience travel and vagabonding?
Well, this is an ongoing conversation. I mean, there's a great George Orwell essay called The Road to Wigan Pier, I think. And he talks about train travel. It was the same thing. You know, you used to get 40 miles into London from the countryside, you would walk and, you know, or take a horse. And then suddenly there's this train, and it's if it erased the journey. You just sit on this train and read a book. There were similar, when they built roads in Europe 1,000 years ago or more than 1,000 years ago, when improvements in sailing technology, it has made the journey easier, but it has also erased part of that travail of travel. And the word travel comes from travail. And I think it's something, there's an extent to which we're going to be fighting to experience those essential travel sensations, because travel is becoming more and more like home and an extension of home. And that's exciting to an extent too. I mean, that sounds kind of awesome. You know, 30 minutes, New York to LA, that sounds kind of amazing. I flew back to Kansas, which is where I'm based, from Boise, Idaho yesterday. And I had an interesting, actually, I usually don't do this again. I'm sort of an introvert, but had an interesting conversation with a guy I was sitting with on the plane. And so that's less likely to happen. I mean, I think there's an extent to which like even a subway ride across New York that might take 30 minutes is now a different experience, because I'm a podcast addict, as I'm sure you probably are. You host.
Oh, absolutely.
And so I just like, that subway experience where my early days in New York, I may have been more interactive and I may have been talking to people. Now I'm, you know, being educated by a podcast, and it has sort of erased that as a travel experience. And of course, podcasts have enriched my life, and so I'm not going to complain about it, but that has also erased that firsthand experience, which is the gift of travel, you know? And so I think there might be a point at which, as mindful travelers, as vagabonders, we'll just have to play games with our travels and turn off those devices, you know, ride a bike instead of taking the Hyperloop or whatever, you know, just create ways to slow down. And that's a great way to go. I was speaking to an audience in Idaho a few days ago in Boise, and there were some bicyclers in the room, and man, they're bicycle hobbyists. They weren't really, using a bicycle as a window into travel. They were traveling because they were into bicycles, but they just have experiences at the bicycle pace that you don't have when you're flying or in a rental car or whatever. And so I think that kind of mindful inefficiency in travel is going to become more important. Even when you have the Hyperloop, if you really want to be vagabonding, find a more interesting way to get from New York to LA.
Well, it's interesting you mentioned like the cultural experience of it, because I know for myself, like like all through my education, we hear certain things about, you know, how it is in China or how it is in these different countries. And then for myself, when I went to China and experienced it for a long period of time, it was very different than, you know, what I was expecting when I went there. For you, was there, what was the country you went to that was very much more different than you expected it to be when you traveled there?
Probably. And I was, in a passport sense, I was a pretty late traveler. I didn't have a passport till I was 25. My first vagabonding trip happened back when you could go to Mexico and Canada without a passport. And so, but the parts of Mexico I went to and the areas in Canada I went to weren't that much different than the United States. I think it was going to Korea in the dead of winter when I, when I just turned 26 and I wasn't really sure where I was going next in life and I wanted to travel some more. And I had a very important 2 years in Korea working as an English teacher and saving money and learning about other cultures. But that's when, I mean, it's one, you can watch streaming video and webcam type stuff from all over the world, but you can't really smell it, you know? And so stepping out into a Korean street in the winter and just realizing the deep, deep fundamental difference, at the smell level of a place like Korea. And then eventually, you know, Korea is an industrialized country. So it had different smells, different foods. It's not a very diverse country. If you're in Korea, you're Korean. You know, there's no hyphenated version of Korean. So I got used to that. And then I went to the Philippines, which has its own smells and is not as industrialized as Korea. And I think that multi-sensual part of travel has always been one of my favorite things. It just stepping off of the airport bus into a neighborhood and getting this brand new smell, you know, and there's, you know, it engages, these places engage all the five senses, but it's amazing how evocative smell can be to just say, look, you're not, this isn't a webcam. This isn't a travel brochure or a book or a fantasy. You are here. And it's exciting.
Definitely. Well, Rolf, what would you say is your biggest skill set and how do you feel that you've developed that?
Biggest skill set, probably observation to an extent, sort of being, again, you know, peeling back the American compulsion to talk and just instead listening and making connections, I think. And my job, you know, I do some teaching and some public speaking, but writing is my core job. And a lot of what I do is reporting, but it's also making connections. So I think not only the ability to observe in a way that's more deliberate and slower than I might have been at another time in life or other people who have other skill sets might have, but also making connections between different my cultures and home cultures and different cultures, histories, travel writing, you know, which is sort of my core job, is multidisciplinary. And so at a time in society where jobs are very specialized, I have the privilege of using the lens of architecture or biology or sociology or ethnology or food or soccer or whatever to see a new place. And so I think my skills, my ability to make connections between these different lenses and between these different disciplines is a strength that has lent itself well to travel writing.
Definitely. Well, another question we have from a listener is from Zach Benson, and he wants to know how technology has changed how you travel and your travels, like how it's changed the actual mechanics of it for you.
Oh, it's deeply changed it. You know, my first trip, my 1994 trip was I didn't use the internet. Some people did back then. And that was all books. And I had like a 1993 Let's Go guidebook. And in fact, I was more isolated during that time than I was half a decade later. You know, I called home once a week, once every 2 weeks, and that was it. And then I sort of started my international travels during the era of dial-up internet. And of course, now travel makes, you know, we've already covered some of this ground in this conversation. It makes travel so much easier, but it also isolates you from the more direct central experiences of travel. So I'd say it has affected me like everybody else, you know, that it's just made travel easier. I carry less when I travel. I went around the world with no luggage 7 years ago, sort of as a stunt.
Wow.
I just went with, you know, a vest full of pockets with a few extra clothes and items for the journey. And it's actually gotten easier since then. Like so much is contained in your smartphone that all your guidebook information, all of your entertainment, your camera, is right there in your smartphone. In fact, when I flew to Idaho this weekend, I just took a tiny little day pack for 3 days. And so definitely, I'm not going to hold myself up as this perfect person who knows the balance between using and not using technology, because sometimes I think I fall back on it too much. But what I try to do is use it just to make my load lighter, to be able to carry less and experience more in my immediate environment. It's not always perfect. Sometimes I'm staring at the black mirror when I should be staring at Argentina or Mozambique, but that's my goal, is to use technology to optimize travel instead of confuse travel with the black mirror back home.
Definitely. Well, Rolf, before we jump into some rapid fire questions, the audience is always looking to know, like, what are busy people doing in the next 6 to 12 months? So what do you have going on in the next year, man?
I know more about the next 6 months than the next 12 months, which is nice. It's nice to not know exactly where you're headed over the long term. But probably the biggest thing, I teach a writing class in Paris every summer. I've been running that since 2005, which sounds like forever. And I guess it has been a long time. So I'm going to go to Paris and hopefully do some side trips from there. And then my nephew, for his 15th birthday, I gave him a trip to Paris and Iceland. So he's going to fly into to Paris, and then we're going to go to Iceland and drive around the island for a week. So it's not far flung adventure type stuff. It's a journey with my family, and then a Paris trip that I do every year. But gosh, I'm as excited for those trips as I am for anything.
Love it. Well, Rolf, we're about to come in for a landing, but before we do, are you ready for some rapid fire questions?
Let's do it.
All right. You are selected to give a commencement speech. What's your topic?
Time wealth, you know, realizing that cash and possessions aren't what you should pursue after you graduate. Those things are important. I'm not knocking time and possessions, but man, you have to, if you don't realize that time is what you own and what you should optimize as wealth, then, you're running the risk of having a less joyful and interesting life than you could be living.
If you got to pick the quote on your tombstone, what does it say?
What popped into my head is a facetious thing, which I've told people before. I shall never more hear thy sweet chirrup, alas. It's a line from Huckleberry Finn for this sort of 19th century goth girl who had buried her canary, and it said, I shall never more hear their sweet chirp, alas. So I've always thought that would be my smart ass gravestone thing. And maybe that will be. Maybe I don't need some sort of philosophy to hand on to the next people. Maybe I should have a facetious, just live my life as well as I can, and then let my gravestone be a winking smart assy statement to the future.
Very cool. Well, other than a guidebook, what book do you travel most with?
Ooh. You know, I don't know if there's a single book that I repeatedly travel with, but sort of my travel Bible is Leaves of Grass by Walt Whitman, which comes up again and again in Vagabonding. And I think sometimes when I feel like my inspiration has dried up a little bit and I'm a little bit too self-absorbed and sullen about life, then I can go back to Leaves of Grass and sort of be inspired and be reminded to live life in an exuberant and outward looking way.
What's your favorite country you've traveled to?
Oh, that's a tough one, because people often ask that. Whew. This might sound like a cop-out, but probably the United States. I love countries around the world, from Laos to France to Egypt, to Argentina. But man, there's just so, you know, the United States is my first travel love. It's where I first did my first vagabonding trip. And there's just, it's so rewarding to return to, especially the American West, but even the American East. It's just, and I like to think that that's a message of encouragement to people who don't quite have the resources to do far-flung travels, that they're right at our doorstep. There's a lot of great stuff here in the U.S.
Well, for me, it was Peru, though we didn't go to Cusco. I did the other side of the country the whole time. We did Tacna, Arequipa, and Lima.
Awesome. Well, Cusco is great. And you've covered a lot more Peru than me.
I've never been to Cusco. I have to go yet.
Well, that's something to look forward to. So that's what was it that grabbed you about Peru?
I actually got to do a service trip for Rotary International. So we helped build buildings and raise money and that kind of stuff. We were there for like a month.
Yeah, that's a great way to go. I'm big on volunteering and even finding ways to volunteer even without sponsorship, you know, just finding different ways to interact with a place. And it sounds like in your case, it paid off really well.
Oh my gosh, absolutely. Those are people I'm still very, very good friends with. It's amazing what happens with those relationships you travel on.
Those are intense. It's sort of a gift. You know, we grow up and we have little clusters of friends from high school and college, but then suddenly you travel and you have all these travel friends. It's great.
Definitely. Well, if you got to define adventure, Rolf, how would you define it?
Pushing your comfort zone. And that is, for some people, it can be jumping out of an airplane with a parachute on. But I think for most people, it's just doing something that you wouldn't normally do. And that can be just walking two blocks from the tourist zone in an unfamiliar city and seeing what happens to you, or taking a bus to a city you've never heard of and having an adventure on those terms. And this is something that can happen at home too, being like an introvert like me, being more of an extrovert. So I think it's very simple. It's pushing past your comfort zone at all levels, most of them deceptively simple.
Well, I really appreciate you hanging out with us today, Rolf. This has been awesome, and I've really been looking forward to this. But if our listeners want to connect with you and learn more about what you're doing, where's the best place for them to do that?
RolfPosch.com. It's been my online home since 1998. I just updated it last November. And so it's a rich resource of my stories, a lot of links, sample chapters from all of my books, interviews with other travel writers, random musings on my blog. There's a link to my Travel Around the World with No Luggage blog on there. And it also links to my social media, but because I have a complicated relationship with media, I'm not super current on Instagram and Twitter and Facebook, but there are links there. But start at RolfPotts.com.
Awesome. Well, Rolf Potts, thank you so much for being on the Create Your Own Life podcast today.
Good to talk to you, Jeremy.